Victor DeNoble and Charles Evans Jr. will be taking part in a Q&A session at the Film Forum. It's the 7:50 screening tonight and then tomorrow night as well, and on Saturday at the 3:15 screening. For more information, visit our show page at WNYC.org. Policymakers often seem to be stumped about how to improve failing public schools in low-income areas. Up next, Mark Warren talks about the role that community organizing can play. And we're also joined by Desiree Pilgrim-Hunter, who leads a community coalition in the Northwest Bronx. Later on, a political scientist talks about going undercover for 5 months in one of the country's largest slaughterhouses, where a cow is killed every 12 seconds. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast, and you can find me on Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC is supported by Roundabout Theater Company's Broadway production of The Road to Mecca by Athol Fugard and starring Rosemary Harris, Carla Gugino, and Jim Dale. Gordon Edelstein directs. Previews begin December 16th. Tickets available at roundabouttheater.org. Adelphi University, hosting an open house for graduate students on Tuesday, January 10th from 4:30 to 7:30 at its Garden City campus, with discussions on programs of study, admissions, and financial aid options with university representatives. More at adelphi.edu/RSVP. Les Trois Petits Cochons, purveyor of all natural pâté and charcuterie, crafting small handmade batches for over 35 years, available in gourmet markets in Manhattan and throughout the United States. More information at 3pigs.com.
When you give to WNYC by December 31st, you do three things at the same time. You support the programs that you rely on, you enrich your community by strengthening public radio for all listeners, and you get a tax deduction. Don't forget, your gift today will help pay for another year of great public radio in 2012. Visit WNYC.org or call 1-888-376-WNYC to make your tax-deductible gift now. And thanks.
The role community organizers play became a matter of public discussion during the 2008 election, when it was often used to describe Barack Obama's beginnings in politics. Actually, community organizing has helped shape reforms in affordable housing, immigration, and especially schools for over 50 years. Harvard University education professor Mark R. Warren discusses its role in education reform through a series of case studies in a new book he has co-authored with Karen L. Mapp called A Match on Dry Grass, Community Organizing as a Catalyst for School Reform. It's published by Oxford University Press, and I'm pleased that it has brought Professor Warren along with Desiree Pilgrim-Hunter to our show. She's the board president and leader of the Northwest Bronx Community and Clergy Coalition. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mark, many have tied community organizing to the labor movements of the 1930s, but you say that the movement owes more to the civil rights and women's rights movements?
Yes, I think that there are a lot of traditions that feed into the community organizing movement, and one of them certainly is the labor movement in Chicago with the work of Saul Alinsky going back to the 30s. But and that, I think, is the more well-known tradition. But there's also a very strong tradition, similar ones that fed in and through the civil rights movement, the work of Ella Baker, for example, and then really since then, the women's movement, the immigration movement, and today's community organizing work around education, I think, draws from all of these efforts.
Even today, many years after he's died, Saul Alinsky's name still is invoked by some people as a kind of a boogeyman.
Well, I think that whenever someone goes out and organizes poor people, that is a radical thing to do in this country. And I think that's what Saul Alinsky did. And he organized people to really speak for themselves, to have a role in shaping policy and shaping their own lives.
Well, Desiree, how essential is an understanding of the workings of the community itself in organizing for educational reform?
Those who are most affected by the situations, especially in education, are the ones that we train and we work with to talk up, speak up about all of the issues that go on. I'm a parent who came face to face with this overcrowding issues, with the impossibility of getting a good education, public school quality education, for the children in our community. And so it's very important that these folks, through organizing, through all of leadership development and all those things, are able to speak up and say, you know what, this is my community and I want an education that makes sense.
Well, how local is all of this? Would the tactics of an organization located in the Northwest Bronx be all that different from someone working in Brooklyn or Staten Island?
Not really. The organizing is about all of us coming together to get the system to recognize that they're not educating the kids and that they're disconnecting the parents and the youth from the decision-making processes about these schools, no matter where they are.
But, Mark, is it still a local thing? Does education reform work on a national level where many of the rules have been set?
Well, I think that we found in studying organizing efforts across the country that it is still primarily a local phenomenon.
And there is no national organization that advocates in the way that the NRA, for example, would advocate for gun owners.
Not in the same way. I think that over the last few years, we have seen efforts to bring some of these local groups together nationally. So there is various formations like Communities for Public Education Reform, the Alliance for Educational Justice, which has worked with a lot of youth groups, the local groups here.
With.
I think these are new efforts to try to figure out how to do this. But I also think that, despite this, the importance of federal policy, you know, education in this country has still been primarily a local concern and a state as well. And that these groups have a lot of ability and capacity to influence school reform right on the ground where they live, and that these are very important things.
And you begin your book by looking into how community organizing actually works. How does developing relationships with the locals lead to a transformation in the schools and in the community?
Sure. I think we started out with the idea that maybe a stereotype, maybe related to your bogeyman kind of idea that, you know, organizing is really about marching and demonstrating and protesting and shouting. And certainly there is a mobilization side to organizing. But what we really found was that the organizing groups that were able to make a difference in education were those that really sunk deep roots into communities, really built relationships among and across people, parents, young people, relationships with teachers, work, did the hard work of developing parents' capacity to contribute to school reform, and then tried to engage directly with educators to transform schools.
So you say that it's important to address power dynamics between parents, teachers, and officials.
Well, it is.
There is some inequity in the system, isn't there?
There's a fundamental inequity in the system. And that's why we and many people say that educational inequality today is the civil rights issue. Well, if it's the civil rights issue, that means that it's going to take a movement, an organization of people who are directly affected to change that. Now, not on their own, not only by protesting, but by trying to figure out ways to work with educators who have more education, who have more resources, who control our public institutions. There's your power dynamic. And what we're trying to say is there a way for people to collaborate, to share power, to rearrange these power dynamics so that people can work together to better the situation for children?
Is that what happened with you, Desiree? Did you feel there was an imbalance of power before you joined the Northwest Bronx Community and Clergy Coalition?
Yes, it was very difficult as a parent to figure out how do I, you fight, and then you don't get anywhere.
Because you're doing it as an individual?
As an individual. So once I got connected with the Northwest Bronx Community and Clergy Coalition, all of a sudden now I'm in relationship with a lot of other parents, and then I'm also in relationship with other groups locally and nationally. And so all of a sudden our organizing took on a whole different way of going. We were able to really form collaborations. We were able to create campaigns and specifically come up with platforms to address and the issues that were going on and actually aim them at the specific people, because that's the other thing. Most parents won't fight because they don't know who it is the key decision maker. And until you get to that person and let them know we're on to you, we are going to keep coming to you until you solve this issue. And if you don't, then we're going to, you know, let everyone know that you're the one.
But in some schools, the PTAs are more effective than others. Isn't the PTA the way it's usually done? And why wouldn't it be all that effective in the Northwest Bronx?
Well, PTAs are subject to, even though the parent-teacher associations are supposed to be sort of a an oversight, they've been reduced to by the school system to being a fundraising vehicle. And when you...
You don't want to make to have a cake sale? Is that it?
Not when my child is likely to end up on the streets because they don't have a decent education. And so the PTAs, in fighting the principals are fighting. Everyone is fighting, but we're not getting affecting the proper solution.
Well, our current Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, has said that the parents' role is to feed, clothe, shelter, and help the children with their homework. That's kind of setting a rather low standard for the parents, isn't
it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think part of the problem, and we see this everywhere, particularly when you talk to educators working in low-income communities, the stereotype is that parents don't care. And if they can just feed and clothe their child, that's good enough. And we set out in the book to try to document that this is exactly the opposite. In fact, the whole title, A Match on Dry Grass, came out of the idea that when you really actually go out and start talking to parents in communities across this country about what's happening with the education of their children, it's like throwing a match on dry grass. The response is just so strong and overwhelming. And there's really a movement across this country in Mississippi Delta and in California, in Denver, in Chicago, all the different places that we went, where parents are trying to find a way to have a meaningful say. It's partly about, yes, raising your child. It's partly, but it's also about having a meaningful say and a way to contribute to the education that they're receiving.
Well, you draw a distinction between parental involvement and parental engagement.
Right.
What's the difference?
Well, by involvement, I think we are typically thinking of the school and the teacher say, well, we want an individual parent to, as you say, feed and clothe their child, maybe help them with their homework, a very individual notion of being involved in education on a kind of the teacher's or the school's terms. What we're saying is engagement is really about a much broader role. It includes involvement, but it also includes coming into the schools to contribute, to finding ways to connect the community and the resources that are happening, and giving people, as I said, a meaningful say in some leadership roles. And we've seen parents do all kinds of things, open up community learning centers, start Grow Your Own Teacher programs where they themselves have a chance to become teachers in schools. In Mississippi Delta, parents and community residents organized to increase funding by education by $600 million across the state.
But I think it's also deeply insulting when you tell a parent whose primary responsibility is the development of their own child, that you draw the square around them and say, this is only your responsibility. I'm the daughter of a teacher. My father taught us at home. When you see that the homeschooling movement grew because that people were dissatisfied that what was going on in the schools, they took control of it of themselves. But our children are guaranteed a quality public school education, and they're not getting it. They're not even being miseducated now. They're no longer being educated, period.
Well, are we seeing some kind of polarization in this country when a presidential candidate like Newt Gingrich says the parents aren't involved enough, they're not acting as decent role models, and so we should have the kids do janitorial and custodial work in the schools?
Oh, my gosh. That was a moment that enraged me because I looked at this and said, first of all, We are the only freedom that for the kids who do not have all the resources of somebody who's wealthy is the education. And so they need as much resources and as much education as they can get to level the playing field. But what he's saying is we don't want you there. We want you just to clean up after us, but we don't want you to have this education. And parents shouldn't be bothered.
Well, getting back to the sort of thing you do, Desiree.
Yes.
How do you get parents familiar with pressing local issues like overcrowding in the schools? How do you reach them and tell them that they can do something?
Well, we actually work through. We have two arms with the parents. As with a situation that we have going on right now, we have a school that has toxic poisons in it. And the parents find out way after the Board of Education already knew. So what we did is we brought the parents together. They organized themselves, and we sat down with them to figure out who was responsible and what they needed to do to address this issue.
Well, your organization also says clergy coalition. So
that's correct.
If you can't reach the parents through the school sending notes home with their kids, Do you go to the churches and other community groups?
We reach parents through the churches. We reach parents through community-based other community-based organizations. We have a youth arm called Sisters and Brothers United. So we reach through the youth themselves, through the PTAs, through the teachers.
And that, Mark, you say that low-income communities are not typically connected through schools. Why not?
They're not, in fact. People have relationships with each other in low-income communities, but not around the school. They might be around congregations, as Desiree is talking about. I think the reasons are a number of them. I think that schools, for the most part, have not been particularly welcoming to low-income parents. Oftentimes, a parent comes into the school because there's a problem. They're coming in to complain, or they're being invited in because their child has been gotten into trouble. And that's not a positive relationship. And also, if many parents who themselves were not very successful in school, in their own schooling, are, you know, understandably hesitant in lacking in confidence in terms of coming into the school. One of the things I think that's very important about community organizing is that it brings parents and young people together as a group. So it's not just the individual parent having to go into a school on her own. She's coming in with a group of other parents who are supporting each other, and also not just necessarily to complain, but to also to find some positive, constructive ways.
We have about 30 seconds. Are they closing any of the schools area?
Yeah, right now we were supposed to have a meeting yesterday with the Department of Education around Samuel Gompers High School to try to save that school. We were working with the city councilwoman in that area. Then on Friday, we were told last Friday that they had made a final decision. They were closing the school and there is no recourse. And so we are now in a position where we the parents are saying, okay, what's the phase out plan? What went into the decision making? Because we're advocating now for some type of an oversight committee to be a part of that decision making.
My guests have been Desiree Pilgrim Hunter, board president and leader of the Northwest Bronx Community and Clergy Coalition, and Mark R. Warren, co-author with Karen L. Mapp of A Match on Dry Grass, published by Oxford. Thank you so much.
Thank you.